From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The victims told us that the Marines came in and they killed everybody in sight. In one house, they threw a grenade into a kitchen. That set off a propane tank and nearly destroyed the kitchen and killed several people in that home. The scenes that were described by the survivors and the witnesses were incredibly bloody and very graphic. But they're unfortunately very commonplace in Iraq.
The Haditha massacre. An internal military investigation found U.S. Marines killed as many as 24 Iraqis, including women and children, in Haditha last November, then tried to cover it up. Murder charges may be filed against some of the soldiers involved. Then we turn to East Timor, where rioting continues between the country's military and police forces as international troops move in. We'll speak with the co-founder of the East Timor Action Network. He's just back from Timor. The home he was staying in was attacked. We'll also speak with the East Timor ambassador to the United States and UN, José Luis Gutierrez.
We have a dramatic situation in East Timor. Many people live in fear in the capital, and some have died already.
We will also look at the situation in Indonesia, where a weekend earthquake has left more than 5,400 people dead, 200,000 homeless. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Military investigators have determined U.S. Marines wantonly killed unarmed Iraqi civilians, including women and children, in the city of Haditha last November. An internal investigation determined the Marines fatally shot as many as 24 Iraqis, then tried to cover up the killings. One 10-year-old Iraqi girl said she watched Marines kill her mother, father, grandmother, grandfather, 4-year-old cousin, and 2 uncles. The incidents being compared to the massacre at My Lai during the Vietnam War. Several Marines involved in the killing are now being held at Camp Pendleton Brig in California. At least one Marine has spoken to the media about what he witnessed. Lance Corporal Roel Ryan Briones told the Los Angeles Times he was not involved in the killings, but took photographs and helped remove the dead bodies. Briones said, quote, "They range from little babies to adult males and females." We'll have more on the Haditha massacre in a few minutes. In other news from Iraq, 2 more journalists have died while covering the war. On Monday, a roadside bomb killed CBS cameraman Paul Douglas and sound technician James Brolin. CBS reporter Kimberly Dozier suffered severe injuries and remains in critical condition. Earlier today, Dozier was transported to Germany for medical treatment. At the time of the attack, the CBS crew was embedded with a unit of the 4th Infantry Division. This is Kimberly Dozier's brother, Michael Dozier.
People understand the risk that our troops expose themselves to, but don't always appreciate that journalists are in harm's way as well. And she, more than others, I mean, she was not content to report from the rooftop of a hotel. She had to be out there in the Humvee.
In Indonesia, the death toll from Saturday's earthquake has risen to 5,400. More than 200,000 people have been left homeless and have been forced to live in makeshift tents. Many are still waiting for help. The 6.3 magnitude earthquake that hit central Java was the third major disaster to strike Indonesia in the last 18 months. Meanwhile, concern is growing that a volcano near the epicenter could soon erupt. Plumes of smoke are now rising out of the volcano and trails of lava are running down its slopes. In Afghanistan, thousands took part Monday in the most violent anti-U.S. protests in the capital of Kabul since the fall of the Taliban. The riots were sparked by a traffic accident involving a U.S. military truck. Within hours of the crash, protests had spread throughout the city. By day's end, at least 14 people died, another 100 were wounded. Police stations were set on fire. Hotels came under attack. The Office of CARE International was torched to the ground. Stores were ransacked. The U.S.-backed government imposed a nighttime curfew for the first time in 4 years. Protesters called on the U.S. to end its occupation of Afghanistan.
We want America out of this country. We hate America. They have no responsibility. Their army drunk and they're driving on the roads, killing innocent people. We want America out of this country. Sooner or later, we hate America.
Meanwhile, U.S. forces killed about 50 Afghans in an airstrike in the town of Helmand in southern Afghanistan. Over 400 people have now died in the region over the past 10 days. In news from the Guantanamo Bay prison, the U.S. military has acknowledged 75 detainees are once again taking part in a mass hunger strike. Meanwhile, a new report from the British Prisoners' Rights Groups, or PRIEVE, has estimated the Bush administration has held over 60 juveniles at Guantanamo who were captured before they turned 18 years old. In news from Washington, the Justice Department has requested the federal courts dismiss two lawsuits challenging the National Security Agency's domestic warrantless surveillance program. Government lawyers maintain the lawsuits cannot proceed because they would result in the disclosure of state secrets and jeopardize national security. Meanwhile, the Senate has confirmed the former head of the NSA, General Michael Hayden, to become the next director of the CIA. 25 Democrats joined voting with the Republican majority in confirming Hayden. One Republican, Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter, voted against President Bush's nominee. Hayden becomes the first military officer to head the CIA in over 25 years. In other news from Washington, questions still remain over the legality of the FBI's raid on the office of Democratic Congressmember William Jefferson. It marked the first time the FBI has ever raided the office of a sitting member of Congress. Last week, House Speaker Dennis Hastert and other lawmakers demanded any material seized in the raid be returned to the congressman who's under investigation for bribery. However, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and FBI Director Robert Mueller have defended the raid. According to press accounts, Gonzalez, Mueller, and Gonzalez's deputy, Paul McNulty, signaled to the White House they would resign before returning seized evidence in the bribery investigation. On Thursday, President Bush ordered the Jefferson materials to be sealed for 45 days while justice officials and House lawmakers work out their differences. The New York Times reports the Pentagon is pressing Congress to approve the development of a global strike missile that would enable the United States to carry out non-nuclear missile strikes against any target in the world within an hour. However, critics say the weapon could lead to an accidental nuclear war. That's because the Pentagon plans to deploy the non-nuclear warhead atop the submarine-launched Trident II missile. The same submarines that carry nuclear Trident II missiles would also carry the non-nuclear version. Critics say it would be hard for other countries, such as Russia, to determine if a missile coming out of a Trident submarine was conventional or nuclear. Burma's military junta has extended the house arrest of pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi by another year, despite a call for her release by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. The 1991 Nobel Peace Prize laureate has spent 10 of the past 16 years in jail. The military junta announced its decision May 27th, exactly 16 years after Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy party won 82% of the vote in a general election. But the military refused to allow the party to take power. The international community, including the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, denounced the Burmese government's decision. This is in Kalthuli of the Karen Nation National Union.
That is a very senseless, from the very beginning, a senseless act of SPDC. Aung San Suu Kyi is just a woman without any weapon, and all she asked for is a dialogue for democracy, dialogue to sort out Burma's problem, and to sort out problems, and finally to move towards to genuine democracy.
And SPDC. In Colombia, Alvaro Uribe has been reelected the country's president. The staunch U.S. ally won 62% of the vote in Saturday's race. On Monday, President Bush called Uribe to congratulate him. In Moscow, over 1,000 police officers broke up the city's first ever gay pride march. Up to 100 people were arrested, including the lead organizer of the march. Riot police dragged march participants away as they attempted to speak with the press. One gay rights activist was beaten by a gang of counter-protesters while he was giving a televised interview. Moscow's mayor, Yuri Lushkov, had banned the march, citing moral reasons. An official from Human Rights Watch said the police were encouraging skinheads to attack gay men and lesbians participating in the march. Prior to the event, organizer Nikolai Alexeyev outlined why a gay pride march was needed in Russia.
We got no rights, basically, that are given to people in other countries, to gays in other countries. And I think the time came to go out and to say that we want also equal rights. You see, we're paying taxes as all the other citizens. We are we have obligations. We are following our obligations according to the law, and we are supposed to get the same rights as all the other citizens. And this is what the authorities should understand.
Gay March organizer Nikolai Alexeyev. This is Democracy Now! As we turn to our last headline, in Nevada, protesters have forced the Bush administration to indefinitely postpone a controversial bomb test designed to help the military better understand nuclear bunker busters. The government had planned to set off 700 tons of explosives in the Nevada test site, creating an explosion 50 times more powerful than the Army's largest conventional bomb. According to government documents, the test, known as Divine Strike, was needed to determine the, quote, proper nuclear yield necessary to destroy underground facilities. The Pentagon estimated the blast would have been so large it would have created a 10,000-foot-high mushroom cloud. Critics called for the government to cancel the test because they feared the mushroom cloud would contain radioactive dust from old nuclear tests. And Jamaican music pioneer Desmond Dekker has died at the age of 64. He died of a heart attack last week at his home in Surrey, England. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we begin today by looking at the Haditha massacre and the aftermath, which has continued to rock the military and political establishments. Last November, a roadside bomb struck a Humvee carrying U.S. troops in the western Iraqi town of Haditha. The bomb killed one Marine and injured two others. The next day, the Marines said in a statement, 15 Iraqi civilians died in the initial blast. They said that after the explosion, gunmen attacked the U.S. convoy with small arms fire, prompting the Marines to return fire, killing eight insurgents. But eyewitnesses contradicted this account. They said the men, women, and children were killed when Marines burst into their houses after the blast and shot them dead in their nightclothes. Early this year, a videotape of the aftermath of the attack, showing the bodies of women and children, was obtained by Time magazine. The video verified the eyewitness accounts and prompted an investigation by the military. There are now two investigations, one into the encounter itself and another into whether it was the subject of a cover-up by the military. Last week, the Pentagon concluded one of its investigations. Members of Congress who were briefed said at least some members of the Marine unit may be charged with murder, which carries the death penalty. This is Abdul Salam al-Kubaisi, spokesperson for the Muslim Clerics Association, speaking at a news conference in Baghdad on Sunday.
The situation has reached a level when the U.S. soldier becomes a professional killer. He kills with premeditation and deliberation. This should be among war crimes, and the ones who should be put on trial are the U.S. commanders and not the U.S. soldier, because the commanders are the ones who instruct those soldiers and justify their acts, as it happened in Abu Ghraib scandal.
That was Abdul Salam al-Kubaisi speaking on Sunday. One of the reporters who first broke the Haditha story, Aparasim Ghosh, joined us in our Firehouse studio in March. He's the chief international correspondent for Time magazine. We wanted to go back to replay a clip of Aparasim from that day. I began by asking him to tell us about his story in Time called One Morning in Haditha.
Haditha is a small town northwest of Baghdad, a very, very dangerous place. It's in the heart of what's known as the Sunni Triangle. And Marines and soldiers who operate in that area are under constant threat. On the morning of the 19th of November, a four Humvee patrol going through town was hit by an IED, an improvised explosive device, which sheared off the front of one of the Humvees, killed one of the soldiers inside. What happens next is a matter of some debate. As you pointed out, initially the Marines claimed that a total of 23 people were killed on the spot, 15 of them innocent civilians, all of whom the Marines said were killed by the IED, and eight of them enemy combatants who were shot by the Marines and
killed. In addition to the 15.
We looked into this case, and the more we dug, the more we thought that something didn't quite add up. And when we finally got our hands on this videotape, it became very clear to us that these people could not have been killed outdoors by an explosive device. They were killed in their homes, in their night clothes. The night clothes are significant because Iraqi women and children especially are very, very unlikely to go outdoors wearing their night clothes. It is a very conservative society. When we first approached the Marines with this evidence, they responded in quite a hostile fashion. They accused us of buying into enemy propaganda. That aroused our suspicions even further because it seemed to be excessively hostile on their part. And we dug even more. We spoke to witnesses. We spoke to survivors of this incident. And then we became quite convinced that these people were killed by the Marines. What is left to be seen is whether they were killed in the course of the Marine operation as collateral damage or by accident, or whether the Marines went on a rampage after one of their own had been killed and killed these people in revenge.
You're very graphic in the piece, One Morning in Haditha. Describe what the survivors say happened when the U.S. military went into the nearby houses around where the roadside bomb had exploded.
Well, the survivors claim, let me back up a little bit. The Marines claim that they received small arms fire from nearby homes and that they responded to this fire, they shot back, and then they went into the homes to try and flush out the bad guys, the terrorists who were in there. It's clear from the video that those homes don't have any bullet marks outside, which would suggest that there was very little, if any, shooting by the Marines at the facades of these homes. But there are lots of signs of bullets inside. The victims told us that the Marines came in and they killed everybody in sight. In one house, they threw a grenade into a kitchen. That set off a propane tank and nearly destroyed the kitchen and killed several people in that home. The scenes that were described by the survivors and the witnesses were incredibly bloody and very graphic, but they're unfortunately very commonplace in Iraq.
Inside, you have the description of a 9-year-old girl.
Yes.
Tell us about her and her family and what she says happened.
Well, she was indoors with her family when the explosion took place. The explosion was loud enough to wake everybody up in the neighborhood.
The bomb that killed the Marine.
The first explosion, yes. And she says when she heard gunshots, of course, she's a child, she was frightened. When the Marines stormed towards their home, her grandfather slipped into the next room as his apparently was his custom to pray, to reach out for the family Quran and pray to God that this crisis would pass. On this occasion, the Marines came into the home. They entered the room where the grandfather was and other members of the family and killed him.
And she was left alive?
She survived, yes.
And her little brother?
And her brother was injured by a piece of, either by a bullet or a piece of shrapnel, we're not sure.
But her parents, her mother, her father, her grandparents?
Her grandparents, I believe her uncle, were also killed.
And then another house?
4 houses in all, involving a total of, indoors, total of 19 people and 4 people outside.
Aparasim Babighosh on Democracy Now, March 23rd of this year. On Saturday, the Marines released their first official statement about the Haditha killings. It read in part, quote, "All Marines are trained in the law of armed conflict and our core values of honor, courage, and commitment. We take allegations of wrongdoing by Marines very seriously and are committed to thoroughly investigating such allegations. We also pride ourselves on holding our Marines to the highest levels of accountability and standards. The Marines in Iraq are focused on their mission. They're working hard on doing the right thing in a complex and dangerous environment. It's important to remember the vast majority of Marines today perform magnificently on and off the battlefield. Tens of thousands have served honorably and with courage in Iraq and Afghanistan." Again, those are the words of the U.S. military. We invited representative of the Pentagon to be on the program. They declined our request. We're joined now in studio by John Sifton, an attorney and researcher at Human Rights Watch, where he focuses on Afghanistan, Iraq, and military and counterterrorism issues. We're joined on the telephone by Nancy Youssef. She's the Baghdad bureau chief for Knight Ridder. And we're joined on the phone from the Bay Area of California by independent journalist Dar Jamal, who's written a piece for truthout.org called Countless My Lai Massacres in Iraq. He spent more than 8 months in Iraq. Nancy Youssef, what is the response in Iraq right now? I mean, this actually, the Haditha killings took place in November. What is the response of Iraqis to the renewed interest in this?
Surprisingly quiet. I think there's a feeling here that there are a lot of people being killed every day in this country, whether it be by U.S. forces or by militias or by gangs, and it hasn't sort of gained the sort of energy or anger that you're hearing in the U.S. On the contrary, it's been quite quiet. The parliament met the day before yesterday and did not even mention this case.
Dar Jamal is an independent journalist based for more than 8 months in Iraq. Your response to this latest news?
Well, two responses, really. First is that this type of situation, like Hadith, is happening on almost a daily basis on one level or another in Iraq, whether it's a civilian cars being shot up at U.S. checkpoints and families being killed, or, on the other hand, to the level of, for example, the second siege of Fallujah, where between 4,000 and 6,000 people were killed, which I think qualifies as a massacre as well. But even that number hasn't gotten the attention that this Haditha story has. And the other really aspect of that I think is important to note on this is the media coverage, again, surrounding what's happened around Haditha, simply because Time magazine covered it, and thank heavens that they did. But this has gotten so much media coverage, and in comparison, so many of these types of incidents are happening every single week in Iraq, and I think that's astounding and important for people to remember as well.
We're going to go to break. When we come back, I'll ask John Sifton of Human Rights Watch about these military investigations that are taking place. After that, we'll talk about what's happening in East Timor with the rioting in the streets and finally the Indonesian earthquake that has taken the lives of more than 5,400 people. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 420 stations around the country, on Pacifica NPR, Low Power FM, college and community radio stations, as well as on PBS and public access TV stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. You can also find transcripts of all broadcasts there. as we continue to talk about the case of Haditha and other killings in Iraq. Our guests are John Sifton. He is the researcher at Human Rights Watch here in New York. Nancy Youssef is Baghdad bureau chief for Knight Ridder, speaking to us from Baghdad. And Dar Jamal, longtime independent journalist, spent 8 months in Iraq and has done a piece for Truthout on the number of killings that occur around Iraq. John Sifton, the U.S. military investigations of this, can you explain what they are, if they are reliable?
Well, after Time magazine published their account, the Navy Criminal Investigative Service did open an investigation, and it is ongoing. And in fact, what we know now—
But even that took some work.
Yeah, it took a lot of work for Time magazine to convince the Navy commanders to order that investigation. But once it took place, it actually did find a lot of disturbing things, and the new information we have is in large part due to that investigation. The second investigation, which is much more important in some respects, is the investigation into the possibility that officers lied about the incident when it occurred, tried to cover it up. And the question isn't, did a lie take place? Because definitely the first accounts of the incident were erroneous and appear to be falsified. The question is how high up the chain of command those lies went.
And again, the first reports being that there was a roadside bomb that killed a Marine and it killed all these people. That's what they originally said.
Yeah, the initial Marine communique on November 20th was entirely false. It was an account about an IED killing 15 civilians. And the hospital staff later told Time, you know, these were gunshots. There were a lot of holes in that report. It essentially fell apart under the scrutiny of Time magazine's reporting. And that's what started the investigation in March. The problem now is the second investigation. I don't think a lot of people realize how serious that is, because as your earlier commentator said, there's a lot of incidents in Iraq every day. So we shouldn't just be focused on Haditha. We should be focused on the credibility of the Marines and also the possibility that all kinds of incidents take place which don't get reported and don't get investigated.
And the second investigation, who is conducting it?
Well, it's not within the Marines. You know, there are different parts of the military. There's the Army Criminal Investigative Division. There's the Navy Criminal Investigative Service. So this has been taken outside of the Marines, which is a good thing. I mean, the thing is, sometimes these criminal investigators can do a very good job if they are allowed to, and that's the question facing the military. Are they going to let this investigation really run an independent course? There's a lot of problems with the military justice system in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I think it's time for Congress to start considering whether it needs reform. It's just not independent enough.
And this Lance Corporal, Roel Rion Briones, who told the Los Angeles Times he was not involved with killings, but took photographs and helped remove the dead bodies, and said they range from little babies to adult males and females.
Well, if these allegations are true, then this is clearly a war crime. I mean, we're not talking about a firefight or an ambiguous situation where we might wonder if the Marines made a justifiable mistake. This appears from the allegations made by witnesses to be murder and a war crime.
I wanted to turn to another story of killings that took place right about the same time, the exposing of the killings as the Haditha massacre. A few days after that story broke, the military launched another investigation into the killing of Iraqi civilians by U.S. troops. In March, Knight Ridder News Agency obtained an Iraqi police report accusing U.S. forces of murdering 11 civilians by rounding them up in a room of a house near the city of Balad and shooting them. The U.S. military stated only 4 civilians were killed in the raid and that they came under fire while trying to capture an al-Qaeda suspect. The reporter who broke the story for Knight Ridder, Matthew Schofield, was interviewed by Democracy Now! In March. Here is an excerpt of that interview.
There are two accounts. There's a U.S. military account, and then there's an Iraqi police account of what happened. As you know, the U.S. military account is that after showing up and getting into a shootout to get in this house, the house collapsed during the shootout. People were killed either in the shootout or by the collapsing house. They left. They found 4 bodies. And left, they found this suspect. They arrested him. And that's pretty much the end of the story. The other story is that the house was standing when U.S. troops went in. They were herded into one room. 11 people were herded into one room, executed. U.S. troops then blew up the house and left. We were talking with the police officer who was first on the scene earlier today. He explained the scene of arriving. He said they waited until U.S. troops had left the area and it was safe to go in. When they arrived at the house, it was in rubble. I don't know if you've seen the photos of the remains of the house, but there was very little standing. He said they expected to find bodies under the rubble. Instead, what they found was in one room of the house, in one corner of one room, there was a single man who had been shot in the head. On the directly across the room from him and against the other wall were 10 people, ranging from his 75-year-old mother-in-law to a six-month-old child, also several three-year-olds, a couple three-year-olds, a couple five-year-olds, and three other women. Lined up, they were covered in, they had all been shot. According to the doctor we talked to today, they'd all been shot in the head, in the chest, some of them were shot several times. The doctor said it's very difficult to determine exactly what kind of caliber gun they were shot with. So the entry wounds are generally small and round. The exit wounds are generally very large. But they were lined up along one wall. There was a blanket over the top of them, and they were under the rubble. So when the police arrived and residents came to help them start digging in, they came across the blanket. They came across the blankets. They picked the blankets up. They say at that point that the hands were handcuffed in front of the Iraqis. They'd been handcuffed and shot. And the Iraqi assumption is that they were shot in front of the man across the room. They seem to be facing each other. There is nothing to corroborate that. The U.S. is now investigating this matter along with the Hodeitha matter. That's kind of where we stand right now.
Nancy Youssef, can you respond to your colleague at Knight Ridder, Matthew Schofield's report of what happened in Balad?
The name of the town is Azhaki, and we have inquired about that report. And frankly, the people in that town are fearful to talk about it and have told us to go to the Americans, and that their findings are that the Americans' version of things was correct, and that they're very hesitant now to talk about that case. And so we're very aggressively trying to find out why that is and what the status of the U.S. investigation is.
John Sifton of Human Rights Watch, we're reading now in the papers, this is months after the expose of a massacre in Hodeitha, and this was in Balad, the latest story that we've seen, that when news organizations like the New York Times will send someone in, say they're an Iraqi historian, but they won't identify them for fear of them being attacked. Can you talk about the significance of the second report that was exposed at the same time as the first?
Well, there have been a lot of reports. It's difficult to keep track of them, especially when a lot of things are going on all over the world. And that's why the institutional issues are so important. I mean, we can talk about the Hodeitha incident or the Balad incident and about what evidence is out there. But at the end of the day, what concerns us as a human rights group is whether the military has the capacity to self-report about abuses and investigate them properly. And it's looking like it simply doesn't. The question is whether the military needs to reform itself, whether Congress needs to consider reforms to the criminal justice system. Otherwise, the only way you're ever going to hear about these things is when we're lucky enough to have good reporters go in and interview. They can't be everywhere at once. They can't be all over Iraq in every village and every town.
On Memorial Day, the chair of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Peter Pace, says charges will be brought against U.S. Marines if an investigation to the alleged killing of unarmed Iraqi civilians uncovers wrongdoing. Major General Pace also said he still doesn't know why it's taken nearly 3 months for the Pentagon to find out about the November 19th incident in the town of Hodeitha, in which up to 24 civilians were killed.
Yeah, it's not as though the military can't investigate when it wants to. I mean, when things happen like in Italy when a fighter jet hit a gondola, ski gondola, and knocked it down. You know, very quick investigation, court-martial happened. Canadian soldiers in a friendly fire incident in Afghanistan, very quick investigation and court-martial. It's just a question of will, political will, and often the military is lacking in this regard. So that's why we're proposing for the military to have an independent prosecutor's office, as opposed to this current system, which is entirely at the whim of commanders.
Dar Jamal, I'm reading a report from Reuters, and it says a U.S. defense official said Friday Marines could face criminal charges, possibly including murder, in what would be the worst case of abuse by American soldiers in Iraq since the 2003 invasion. Following up on the theme of your piece and Truth Out, can you respond to that?
Well, it's very clear, actually, that willful killing, like everything that we've been talking about this morning, is considered a war crime under even the U.S. War Crimes Act. And people who commit these crimes, particularly when the victim dies, it's punishable not just by life in prison, but the death penalty. And this, of course, goes for the people who committed the act, the people who helped cover it up, on up the chain of command, logically, to the people who set up this whole situation to begin with, including the commander-in-chief and the Secretary of Defense and other people in the administration. And I think that that's what we need to keep in mind, that we're talking about war crimes on and atrocities on the level of the My Lai massacre, and I think even comparable to things that were done during, you know, that we had the Nuremberg trials for. And this is what people need to be held responsible for. And again, as was mentioned earlier, not just the people who committed the act, but the people who set up the entire, all of the conditions that made all of these things possible.
You mentioned our Fallujah before, and I would say most people in the United States have perhaps heard of it as a city. But why do you think it needs to be investigated to the extent that we're beginning to see with Haditha right now?
Well, it needs to be investigated because there's irrefutable evidence that war crimes have been committed there. I saw with my own eyes during the April 2004 siege, where I sat in a clinic and watched men and women and young kids brought in, all saying they'd been shot by snipers when Marines pushed into the city, couldn't take the city, so they set up snipers on rooftops and just started a turkey shoot, which was exactly how it was described by one of the soldiers I ran into when I was leaving that city, watching a 10-year-old boy die in front of my face because he was shot by Marines, other war crimes reported heavily, and that was just from the April siege when 736 people were killed, and then the November siege where between 4,000 and 6,000 people were killed, indiscriminate bombings, snipers, war crimes being committed on the ground by hand by U.S. Marines as well during that siege. And all of these are, of course, gross breaches of the Geneva Convention. They are war crimes, and there's photographic evidence, there's video evidence. Doctors there will, to this day, will talk to you about what happened, and there's absolutely no reason why all of these shouldn't be investigated as well.
John Sifton is a person who's been researching these human rights issues for a long time. What does it take to break through? It obviously isn't the case itself, a massacre or murders. As you said, this is happening regularly. What does it take?
Well, in this case, we saw that Time magazine ran a story, there was an investigation, but then pretty much everybody forgot about it. And luckily, Representative John Murtha brought it up a week or so ago, and that rekindled interest in the story. And so now some new facts are coming out. But again, we can't rely on press reports and pressure from the press, although it helps, to get accountability. Ultimately, there are institutional problems in the military that need to be addressed. But otherwise, we're just going to see case after case getting covered up or forgotten.
Nancy Yusuf, you're in Baghdad. The response of Iraqi politicians who could pick this up now?
Well, it's actually been quite silent. There was an initial sort of outpouring from Sunni politicians after Time's report and our report. But now there's not. There's this effort to say that we're a coalition government, that we represent everyone. One Iraqi politician told me, I don't want to talk about it because I'm afraid I'll be viewed as sectarian. There are so many incidents of injustice that if I only talk about one, then I'm neglecting the others and I could be labeled as sectarian. I wanted to go back to a point earlier about the investigation. I think one thing to keep in mind is that it is very hard now to get Iraqis to talk to military investigators. The people in Haditha told us they don't want to talk to the investigators. They don't want soldiers in their house. They don't want to bring them in. They're not sure that there's any real resolution to it. And I think that's one of the reasons it's so hard to get these sort of investigations completed. The people tell us they don't want to participate. They don't see the benefit in it.
They see the same people, for example, in Haditha, who came into their homes, the U.S. military, as the ones who are now coming to ask them about it? Are they afraid of being identified as, for example, eyewitnesses that could be used against the military?
Well, I'll tell you, like, when we went to Haditha, we talked to the uncle of one of the families in which everybody was killed but a 13-year-old girl. And he started to tell his story, and in the middle of his story, he paused and looked up at us and said, "Please don't let me say anything that will get me killed by the Americans. My family can't take it anymore." And I think that says it all. I mean, there's a fear to talk about it. There's a fear to challenge them, the soldiers, particularly after what they've, if you were directly involved, what they've gone through.
Nancy Youssef is Knight Ridder bureau chief in Baghdad. Can you tell us the story that this man told you?
Sure. As was mentioned, there were several houses involved that were that the Marines entered, and this man is the uncle and one of the men in his house's next door. And basically what happened was the Marines went in, and according to his niece, who's 13 and who survived, her father went to the door to try to open it, and they heard the commotion, and they shot her father. And the father had separated, had put the women and children in a separate bedroom. Her mother was recovering from surgery. She was lying in a hospital. Her sisters were surrounding their mother in their arms with their mother. And she said the Marines came in, they shouted something in English, they didn't know how to respond. The shooting started, she fainted, and when she woke up, her family was dead. Everybody was dead, and all she heard was her 3-year-old brother moaning in pain. He was the only one still alive, and she said to him, "Muhammad, get up, let's go to uncle's house." And he said, "I can't." And so she took them and she held him in her arms, and he was bleeding profusely, and she said she held him until he died. And she crawled over to her uncle's house next door. Her uncle heard all the commotion inside, of course didn't know exactly what was happening, but kept trying to get to the house to help his family, and was stopped by soldiers, he said. And this went on for several hours, and he never knew what happened until his niece showed up at the door and said, "Muhammad, my 3-year-old brother and the family are dead." And he took his niece and his wife and him, they cleaned her up, they took her, and they fled, and they have never been back to their house since.
Nancy Youssef, speaking to us from Baghdad, the bureau chief for Knight Ridder, went into Haditha to investigate the story. John Sifton's Human Rights Watch coming out with a report on this.
Well, we're still working on it, but Nancy pointed out the difficulties in doing this research. Our new approach, which we've been doing over the last year because of the security problems in Iraq, is to interview veterans themselves. And surprisingly, U.S. troops are very engaged to talk about what they've seen in Iraq. A lot of people don't commit abuses. They witness abuses, though, and they want to talk about them. And we've been using that testimony to piece together facts about what's going on. I mean, don't get the wrong idea. There are people out there who see these things and are horrified and report them up the chain of command, and then nothing happens.
And then, of course, there are the eyewitnesses, the victims.
Yeah. I mean, you have witness testimony on the victim side, but also, you know, other Marines, other soldiers who see what's going on and are horrified and want to talk about it. And some of them talk to us, some of them talk to military investigators. And when we piece together things that way, too, it's extraordinarily difficult, but it is feasible.
I want to thank you for being with us, John Sifton of Human Rights Watch, also Nancy Youssef, Baghdad Bureau Chief in Iraq right now of Knight Ridder, and Dara Jamal, independent journalist based in Baghdad, one of the only independent unembedded journalists in Iraq at the time. He publishes his reports at the blog darajamaliraq.com, and we will link to that at democracynow.org. We go to break, then come back and talk about Timor. Stay with us. Freedom Drones by Off the International Radar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to the situation in East Timor. The president there, Xanana Gusmão, assumed emergency powers earlier today in order to give him control over the army and police. Gusmão's order comes as violence in the country has reached its highest level since Timor gained its independence in 2002. At least 30 people are reported to have been killed. Tens of thousands of civilians have been displaced. Several weeks ago, the Timorese Prime Minister, Maria Katiri, fired more than 600 striking members of East Timor's military. This exacerbated tensions between the military and police in what is Asia's newest and poorest state. As rumors of attacks against police units spread through Timor's capital of Dili, police fled, leading to a complete breakdown in security. Last week, UN and East Timorese officials called for the deployment of a multinational peacekeeping force composed of Australian, Malaysian, and Portuguese troops. On Monday, Timor's president and prime minister met in an attempt to resolve the crisis. As the Timorese president, Xanana Gusmão, called for an end to the fighting, protesters gathered outside the meeting, many of them calling for the resignation of the Prime Minister, Maria Katiri. The Timorese cabinet has also asked the Defense Minister, Rogério Lobato, to resign. We're joined in the studio right now by East Timor's ambassador to the United States and the United Nations, José Luis Guterres. And we're joined on the telephone by Charlie Shiner. He's co-founder of the East Timor Action Network and works closely with Lau Hamutuk, Institute for Reconstruction Monitoring and Analysis in Timor. Both of them returned from East Timor yesterday, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Ambassador, let's begin with you. What is happening in East Timor?
We have a very dramatic situation. It started by part of the army being sacked by the government, and what is now called petitioners, they claim of being discriminated in the army. So the problem started as a very small one, but at that time, the government didn't pay much attention to that problem, and so later on it became a huge problem. Then many of our the population of Dili, almost half of them, they took refuge in the mountains and in the eastern or western district of East Timor.
I mean, people, if they've heard of Timor, perhaps the one thing they know is about the slaughter of the Indonesians over a quarter of a century. Mm-hmm. And now, since independence, this is the first time we're hearing about East Timor, and this is to do with Timorese themselves, police, military, gangs fighting against mm-hmm. each other. Charlie Shiner, you were attacked. The house you were staying was attacked. Who attacked it in Dili, the capital of Timor?
Saturday morning, at about 7 in the morning, there was a fight on the street outside our house by two youth gangs. It's most of the violence that's been happening the last few days is not identifiably done by any of the factions of the military or the police, but it's unemployed young men who are organized in groups. Sometimes they're called martial arts groups, but they're more or less gangs that are taking advantage of the current lack of security to settle old scores or to assert their authority. So there were two gangs fighting on the street in front of our house, and then one of them decided for reasons that don't make any sense to me that our house was a target, and they, for about 10 minutes, pelted our house with rocks and smashed all the windows. We left with the support of the U.S. Embassy and Australian military a little bit later, and I've learned since that the house was burned to the ground a few hours after we left. This is one of similar stories could be told by hundreds of people in East Timor. It wasn't anything uniquely targeted at us.
Now, you certainly helped to expose what was going on in Timor for the many years under Indonesian occupation. What is your sense, Charlie Shiner, of where this is coming from and the significance of, well, seeing Australian troops come in once again and then troops from New Zealand, troops from Malaysia, troops from Portugal?
Well, I think it's a very sad day for East Timor and for the people of East Timor, of course, and for all of us who worked so that they could be independent. That they've had to sacrifice their independence slightly and rely on foreign troops. And it will be difficult, I think, for them to recover both independence in terms of political government, but also independence in terms of being able to be treated as an equal, by particularly by Australia, who has taken advantage of them many times. The source of the violence is very complicated. As you talked about before, there were 600 soldiers fired from the military in February because they claimed about discrimination, and then they essentially went on strike. They didn't go to their barracks. But I think that's just sort of the trigger for underlying tensions and differences that are in many different areas. And it's not as simple as to say, well, this is just because the Easterners don't like the Westerners or vice versa, or because the military doesn't like the police, or because people are many young unemployed men particularly are angry that some people have more money and more resources than they do. I mean, all of those are factors, you know, as is the way the government has handled this, particularly the prime minister. A lot of people say he should have handled it better and been more open to discussion. I think there's also a factor that the leaders of the government, particularly the prime minister and the president of parliament, seem unable to separate their party roles from their national roles over the last few weeks or few months even, which tended to exacerbate things because really only the president was calling for national unity. Mm-hmm. When you get all of those things together and you combine it with the fact that the major perpetrators of crimes during the Indonesian occupation were never held accountable, and since then the court system in East Timor for crimes committed since 1999 is not functioning very well, you get a situation where people feel they can commit crimes and get away with it, that climate of impunity has been created. And you also get a situation where people who are victims, for example, the police, there were 12 police that were shot down by the military last Thursday, that they now feel there's no justice that will be available through the courts or through legal processes, so the only way that they're going to get justice is if they take it into their own hands. You combine all those things together, and plus 80% unemployment in the poorest country in Asia, and you get a recipe for disaster.
Ambassador José Luis Gutierrez, do you agree with that analysis? The surprise of many that when there was a strong call for war crimes tribunals to investigate what the Indonesian military had done over 25 years, the Timorese government was not at the forefront of those calls, but simply talking about moving on, and now perhaps the repercussions of that.
Well, the government created with Indonesia a bilateral commission to find the truth and, in the final analysis, search for justice. As you know, we are in a situation where the East Timor is a very small country, is the poorest country in Asia. And we have to know how to live with our big neighbors. What the government did, and in agreement with the president of the Republic, Xanana Gusmão, was to create that mechanism with Indonesia. And the final decision will be taken by the parliament of both countries, Indonesia and East Timor. Since the two countries are now democratic countries, countries that are committed to human rights, I believe that in the end of the day, the two countries will find a solution that will deal with justice and the truth at the same time.
In the sense, that Timorese have that there is no justice, that there's no repercussions for people, for example, attacking others.
I don't share that view because the event that was mentioned by Charles Steiner, where the police officers were shot by some soldiers, the commander of the army forces, General Matarruak, made clear commitment that they will be punished. At the same time, the loot in the streets, many Timorese are not happy with that. I believe that we are today in the right direction since the president announced that he will be the major responsible for the security and defense.
You ran against the prime minister, Mario Kattiri, for the secretary generalship of the party, which would have made you prime minister. You've just returned. Yeah. You pulled out at the end when they weren't going to have a secret ballot, but people were going to raise their hands, and you felt that that would surely tip it to the prime minister, afraid they would be afraid to vote otherwise. Do you think Mario Kattiri should resign, the prime minister of Timor?
Well, I did run for, announce my candidacy to secretary general of my party, a party that together with Al-Kattiri and other 12 members founded in 75, in 74, because I believe that competition for leadership is good for democracy within the party. And when in a democratic society you have democratic parties, then the society will become more transparent and more democratic. So I did it for the main reasons. At the same time, I thought that it was important for us to change the way how the government have been handling the relation with the public. I am more for a dialogue rather than confrontation.
Do you think that the prime minister should resign now? Or are you joining that call?
Right now, my position is that Fretilin, my party, has the legitimacy to govern to the end. And the prime minister, together with the president right now, they are sharing some responsibilities together. In the way how the decision were taken few hours ago, I agree with that, in the sense that the prime minister is not resigning, but probably there will be a reshuffle in the government.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. East Timor's ambassador to the United States, United Nations, José Luis Guterres, and also Charlie Steiner, co-founder of the East Timor Action Network, both just back from Timor. As we end the last minutes of the broadcast with Indonesia, the death toll from the weekend earthquake there has topped 5,400 people. More than 20,000 people were injured in the disaster. As many as 200,000 people have been left homeless, many without shelter, food. The 6.3 magnitude earthquake struck at dawn on Saturday near the ancient city of Yogyakarta in central Java. The president, Yudhoyono, predicted it would take 3 months to provide displaced and injured with basic shelter and medical equipment and regular food supplies as temporarily moved out of his office in Yogyakarta. Emergency aid has begun to trickle in after heavy rain and series of aftershocks initially hampered relief operations. UN officials say more than 22 countries have responded to Indonesia's call for help with aid or pledges of assistance. Among the aid pledge from abroad was $2.5 million from the U.S., $3.8 billion from the European Union. We're going to turn now to Ken Dartanti Sobroto, officer with the United Nations Children Fund with UNICEF. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Can you tell us the situation on the ground?
The situation on the ground now is getting better in terms of the distribution of supplies. Many relief workers have managed to reach even the most difficult areas in central Java as well as the province of Yogyakarta. So in UNICEF, for example, today we managed to get our supplies benefiting about 80,000 people, and they include personal hygiene kits, water, drinking water, as well as latrine equipment. And one children's center today has been opened for the children in the district of Bantu, Yogyakarta.
What is the greatest need people have right now in Yogyakarta?
People now are in need of sanitation facilities because there are many people living in tents, in the internally displaced people camps, and also in hospitals. Hospitals can no longer accommodate patients inside the building. So latrines are badly needed for these people as well as tents because so many people now live outside their houses and the quality of tents are not that good.
Ken Dartante Sobroto, I want to thank you for joining us from Java. UNICEF officer there. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fodoka Deuce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin. Special thanks to Frank Lopez and Megan Whitney. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.